Hi, I'm David Lazarus. This is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of February 1st, 2013.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today, we continue our close look at America's housing market. At least 10 million homeowners aren't feeling the love of recovery. That is to say, they still have underwater mortgages where they owe more than their homes are worth. But some borrowers were thrown a life raft this week. Mortgage heavyweights Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have announced a bailout program for struggling homeowners who are current on their payments. If there's a pressing need to leave their property, they can just walk away. To explain how it'll work, we're joined by Julia Gordon. She's the Director of Housing Finance and Policy at the Center for American Progress. Hiya, Julia.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Right, let's step back for a moment. What are the origins of this program? Why is it coming into being?
There are many people who, for one reason or another, want to leave their home. They have a job in another state. They've been through a divorce. Perhaps someone has died or become ill. And in those cases, it's very important for people to be able to leave the house without having to default on their loan if they don't need to.
Okay, but most of the data out there suggests that the housing market is on the comeback trail at the moment. So why are we offering such a generous program right now?
We still have millions and millions of people underwater. Foreclosures hurt everybody in the process. They hurt the homeowner, they hurt the investor. They depress the values and the surrounding homes, and they're bad for neighborhoods and cities.
So this is good for the homeowner and good for me, his next-door neighbor.
Exactly.
But since Fannie and Freddie are basically propped up by taxpayer money, doesn't this mean that you and I, and everyone listening, taxpayers, will take a hit any time Fannie and Freddie agree to allow this to happen?
Actually, quite the opposite. This program will allow taxpayers to take less of a hit. The worst outcome, both for taxpayers and for homeowners, is always a foreclosure. The only people who get rich on foreclosures are lawyers and sometimes mortgage servicers.
All right, I buy that, but you're basically saying I can have a big piece of bad pie or a small piece of bad pie.
The bad pie is already here to stay. We had a housing crisis and millions of people are underwater on their mortgages. And the fact is, life goes on. So we say to ourselves, what's the second best thing we can do since we can't roll the clock back to before that happened?
It's kind of the rising tide lifts all boats approach to the housing market. There's one element of this program, though, that kind of befuddles me, and that is I can qualify to walk away from my mortgage if I have some of these other eligibilities, and yet if I've got a vacation home, it will be unaffected. Excuse me? If you've got another asset like a vacation home, shouldn't there be some requirement like you got to sell that off before you can walk away from this other loan?
Well, absolutely. Assets are taken into account. When they leave the home, they are going to have to pay Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac something.
What happens to your credit score if you qualify for this program and are walking away from a home?
It's not good for your credit score. It's better than a foreclosure, and it's better than stopping paying on your mortgage just to get out of the home.
We get questions on this topic from time to time. Here's something from Brian from Greenfield, Wisconsin. And Julia, his question is, the company I currently work for is relocating to another state. I've been working there for several years. I don't want to leave, but I'm underwater on my mortgage and it would be difficult to sell in this economy. What advice would you give? If Fannie or Freddie are involved here, it sounds like the first thing he should do is apply for this program.
No, the short sale program is the preferable program and the easier program for people to get into. Brian will have the greatest chance of having his investor forgive any debt that he still owes if he goes through the short sale program. The short sale program has a broader definition of hardship to be able to get into it. However, if for some reason he's unable to sell his house, for example, if he had to move tomorrow or if someone had died or there was an illness that made it difficult for him to engage in the process of selling the house, then that would be a good time just to essentially turn the keys into the lender.
Julia Gordon is Director of Housing Finance and Policy at the Center for American Progress. Thank you very much, Julia.
You're welcome.
The decision to walk away from a major debt like a mortgage is a moral one as well as a financial one. We'd like to hear from you about this issue. Have you had to stop payments and walk away from your home? What were the financial and ethical repercussions of your choice? Send us your stories at marketplace.org. Okay, while some folks will do whatever it takes to get out of their home loan contracts, others are taking advantage of this buyer's market. Housing sales are on the upswing. According to the latest Case-Shiller Index, home prices in November posted healthy gains in a number of big cities. There was a 23% bump in Phoenix compared to last year. San Francisco saw prices rise by 13%. As Jeff Tyler reports, the buying season is heating up this winter.
With interest rates near rock bottom, consumers in Los Angeles are scrambling to lock down real estate.
The prices have started to increase again, and I'm hoping to finalize and close a transaction before that whole, bubble escalates again.
Michelle Saywell is shopping for her first house.
My absolute top price is about $260,000.
I assume that you're going to be spending all cash on this.
No. I will actually need to take out a mortgage like I would imagine most people.
Unfortunately, many other people have also decided now is the time to buy. I tour some houses on a Tuesday, which is open house day for realtors in Los Angeles. This place has a fountain in the front and a pond in the back. Barbara Palmer is the realtor showing the property. In many other U.S. cities, this house would be considered upper middle class.
How would you describe this place?
It's a redone Craftsman, two-story, three bedrooms, two baths, with a fabulous backyard, a fish pond, a guest space in the back, all redone, and it's listed for $1,099,000.
Not exactly cheap, but that hasn't dampened interest.
Have you gotten offers on this already?
There are at least two and more offers coming in, and it was first shown 3 days ago.
Are you seeing people bid up properties?
Yes, absolutely. I sold a house in the Valley that was $310,000 asking. It went for $385,000 in December with 21 offers in 4 days.
Across town in the Westwood neighborhood, it's the same story. Chad Lund is the realtor.
Right now we're in a Spanish-style 1932 home, three bedrooms, two and a half baths, about just shy of 1,600 square feet.
What's the asking price?
We're currently at $899,000. We've got five offers on it.
Out back, I ask mortgage banker Sean McMillan for his impression of the L.A. market.
There's such little inventory out there that everything is getting bid up and maybe even perhaps overpriced and almost unjustifiably just because the competition is so great to get and access the property.
Does that mean the bubble is back?
You know, it's really interesting because there are some properties that are hitting almost those same values as 2005, which is a spike.
Money is pouring in from overseas.
I've seen a lot of cash, and in particular from Chinese buyers.
Los Angeles is an anomaly, but it's not the only one. Susan Wachter is a professor of real estate and finance at the Wharton School. She says foreign money is also pushing up prices in Miami.
There are condos there that are going fast for folks in Latin America who want to have a safe place to put their money.
Real estate is booming again in San Francisco, Boston, and Las Vegas. But Wachter says in most cities, demand is less intense.
Housing prices are still off their highs, and they will be for quite some time. We're not going to rocket back in the country as a whole by any means. It's going to take time.
But that's no comfort for consumers like Michelle Saywell back in Los Angeles.
I never imagined that it would be this difficult.
To escape the competition, she started shopping in less desirable neighborhoods.
You're looking at these places going, okay, they need new floors, they need electrical work done, they may need new plumbing, and you're still losing out.
Michelle made an offer on a fixer-upper, but was beaten out by someone with cash.
That seems to be kind of my dilemma. A lot of buyers out here are actually paying cash. Can you believe it? They've got $250,000 in their back pocket.
But Michelle hasn't lost faith.
I predict by the end of the year, I will be a homeowner.
If you're thinking about entering the market but aren't ready yet, don't panic. Part of the reason for the spike in prices has to do with the lack of new construction. As builders start cranking out new houses to meet demand, experts say that additional inventory should help stabilize prices. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Credit cards are convenient, but they can be costly. Between fees and interest payments, we pay big bucks to use our plastic. And if you thought no other fees were possible, think again. Retailers now have the option to bill you for the fees they pay to the likes of Visa and MasterCard anytime you swipe your card. Now, that had been verboten under the old rules, but the change is part of a $7 billion settlement deal that credit card companies made with merchants last year. Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at what this could mean for consumers.
Credit card swipe fees are usually between 1 and 4% of the price of what you buy. They do add up to more than $30 billion a year. Merchants have long said the fees eat away at already thin profit margins, and now we may get the chance to feel their pain.
Unfortunately, you could start seeing a new retailer surcharge, which we're calling a checkout fee, when you use your credit card to buy goods and services.
Linda Sherry is the director of national priorities at Consumer Action, a nonprofit consumer advocacy group. She says shoppers can be on the lookout for a notice at the entrance of the store about the new fee. You'll also be reminded of the fee when you check out.
A merchant can say to a customer, if you use debit, cash, or check, you're going to pay less than with this credit card, and it helps me out and it'll help you out.
But most of us probably won't see the new fee, says Jeff Leonard with the National Association of Convenience Stores.
Even with all the noise about surcharging, I don't think you'll see surcharging anytime soon.
Leonard points out that 10 states have laws in place that ban the fee, including New York, California, and Florida. And stores are worried about consumer backlash. Even if the new fees aren't passed on, retailers may ask customers to pay in a way that's cheaper for the store, says retail consultant Michael Sansolo.
Everybody's card is not created equal to everybody else's cards.
Sansolo says rewards cards carry higher fees for merchants. Credit cards cost merchants more than debit cards, and debit cards have a two-tier fee system, depending on whether you type in your PIN or sign.
So retailers could make a point with the shopper that if you're using a debit card and you do the signature, it might be a 2 or 3% charge, but if you do it with your PIN, maybe there's no charge.
Sansolo says once consumers have more information about the fees associated with cards, they may choose to use debit instead of credit, or even cash. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Yay, it's letters time. Let me heft the mailbag. Oh, criminy, that's heavy. All right, lots of mail this week about retirement. Like, how should you invest? What can you do to help someone else planning for retirement? How much do you need for retirement? All right, let's delve into this. Our first caller is Molly calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Molly.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So what do you do?
An engineer.
What kind of engineer?
A mechanical engineer.
All right, it's not a choo-choo Charlie kind of engineer.
More like sending stuff into space.
Tell me more. Have you sent anything into space?
I'm new at my job, so this is a new venture, but I'm excited about it. I like space. Space is good.
It's very cool. I mean, what other line of work is there that you can send Chuck Berry into orbit? You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how cool is that? All right, well, let's not talk about classic rock. Let's talk about retirement and other issues related to that. What's your question?
Okay, well, in effort to bolster their retirement fund, my parents are trying to buy a two-family rental property. It's a great location, a great property. There's a lot of potential, so I'm not worried about that investment per se. The problem is that my parents have asked my husband and I to co-sign the mortgage because on paper, their debt-to-income ratio has maxed out. We don't have to put any money down. We are not going to take any of the rental income, but our names would be on the deed and the mortgage. We have only recently bought our first house, so we don't really have a good understanding of the tax implications of our own home, let alone being part of a investment property. So we're just trying to figure out how would this impact us. Would it be better to set up a trust rather than to co-sign? Are we going to be liable for the taxes for the rental income, even though we wouldn't be getting any of it? that kind of thing.
You're raising interesting questions, and it's interesting that you're kind of doing it in reverse of how it often plays out, where a parent has to co-sign for a child, you know, an adult child who's getting their start in the world. I think the first thing that we need to backtrack on, and that is co-signing is a little bit of a misnomer. What you're doing is co-borrowing. And keep okay. that in mind, because all of the responsibilities and accountability that comes with a loan also rest with the co-signer. So you need to be aware of that. I mean, you know, if God forbid something happens to your parents, your name is now on the bottom line, and the
right.
bank will come after you for this. So that's something very important to keep in mind. A lot of financial experts say you should be very wary of co-signing a loan, even with a loved one, because of this, that, you know, it's going to get you on the hook as well. And there are some other implications. For example, if you co-sign a loan for your parents, that's going to end up on your credit report. And if your parents ever miss a payment, that will affect your credit file. So, you know, you just don't want to be connected in that way, right?
Right. I understand that. If we were to go through with this, how does it work if I'm not getting any rental income? Is it allowable for taxes to all be paid by one party, even if you're split in the middle?
Basically, your parents' name will be on the deed. That will make them the formal owner of the property. What you're going to be looking at is being a formal co-owner of the loan, slightly different critter, although related. So I would guess that a lot of the tax implications of the property will fall onto the deed holder. That's your parents. But just remember, if anything happens that's untoward, you're there. You're on the playing field. You're not an innocent bystander. Okay?
Understood. Yes, understood.
All right. Go in with your eyes open. Molly, appreciate the call. Thank you very much. All right. Let's go over now to Mark. He's calling from Ashburn, Virginia. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. So what do you do?
I'm an instructional designer for a high-tech firm.
What does that mean?
I design education.
You design education?
I do.
Like, you know, reading and writing and arithmetic?
That sort of stuff, but for adults.
Oh, okay. So, all right. So you're to blame for our education system.
I guess so.
Then all right, then. You've got some fixes you got to be making soon, I got to say. All right. Tell me what your question is.
Okay. Recently, I used the CNN Money Retirement Calculator to see how much my wife and I would need for retirement. And I put in the numbers, and it said I would need $3.1 million by the time I retire. Yeah. Saving that much pretty much seems impossible for me. And, you know, am I really going to need that much to retire? And should I even bother with these types of calculators?
Mark, you're asking an excellent question. I've done the same thing. I've run these numbers. I also need millions of dollars retired. I'm thinking, what? Who do you think you're dealing with here? Are you kidding me? When it comes to retirement, you're very smart, first of all, that you're just anticipating some of the costs that are coming down the freeway at you. These retirement calculators are a good thing, if for no other reason than because they get you thinking about some of the stuff you should be prepared for. Now, generally speaking, a lot of experts say when you're in your sunset years, you should need about roughly 70% of your current income on a monthly or an annual basis to cover your nut. That's kind of a funky way of looking at it because your expenses might change. You might pay off your house, for example. You might not have kids who have any more requirements anymore. So the whole 70% of income thing should be taken with a grain of salt. Now, when you run a calculator like you did that shows that you're going to need millions of dollars that you're probably not going to have, that's probably what it is reflecting. Let me point you in a different direction. You should find some of the calculators that are out there that will look at your expenses and how they change over time. And I've got a good one for you. If you go to the Motley Fool website, they have a retirement calculator that looks at just that, expenses. In fact, we can put a link up on our website at marketplace.org, and that will help you get a sense of what you're really going to need in your pocket when you get into your dotage.
Sounds great. Thanks.
All right. No, thank you for your call, and thank you for reminding everybody else as well how important this is. And I really just can't emphasize this enough. Retirement, plan for it. You'll be a whole lot happier down the road. All right, let's go to our next caller. That's Chris calling from San Diego. Hiya, Chris.
Hi. How are you?
Good. So what do you do?
I work for a consulting firm doing big data analytics.
Why everybody keeps calling in with jobs that I have no clue about? What do you do?
We will sift through corporate data and figure out what it is you can be doing better.
You mean you do that on behalf of the corporation?
Yes, that's correct.
They can't do that on their own?
That's why they hire us.
Boy, that makes me really wary of a lot of my investments, if these guys have to hire an outsider to come in and tell them what to make of their numbers. So, Chris, what's your question?
So about a year and a half ago, I got my doctorate and I joined the workforce. And since then, I've been able to pay off some student loans, and I've been paying into a Roth and a 401k. But now I'm in a place where I feel pretty comfortable branching out a bit financially. So my question to you is, what are some first steps that I can take to start to diversify my investments?
Oh, that is an excellent question. And I'm so impressed that you're thinking about that, that you're looking at getting your hands and your feet a little dirtier when it comes to your money, because if you don't do it, nobody will. Now, what you're talking about here is asset allocation and diversification. Big words that have lots of syllables. What it basically means, though, is getting all your ducks in a row. And before I run down some of the basics, there's a good document out there, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Those are one of the cops that looks after the stock market. They've got something on their website that gets into asset allocation that's pretty clear, pretty straightforward, and runs it down in good detail. So if you do a Google search for SEC and asset allocation, you'll find this. You can also probably find a link to it on our website at marketplace.org. Here's the nuts and bolts of it, though. You got a few moving parts. For example, stocks, bonds, cash. Those are your three main areas that you need to keep in mind. And the two other moving parts to this are your time frame, how long you have to invest until you're going to need the money, like you're getting into retirement, and also your appetite for risk, which will go down as you get older. When you're looking at asset allocation, basically stocks is going to be one of the first things you're going to look at. That's where the potential reward is highest. It's also where the potential risk is highest. So go in with your eyes open on that one. Bonds are the other side. We see stocks go up, bonds go down, bonds go up, stocks go down. It doesn't always work that way, but generally speaking, and so one hedges against the other. You're going to want to mix those. And chances are, when you're young, you're going to have more stocks in your portfolio. As you get older, the level of bonds will go up because you want less and less risk. Still with me?
Yes, sir.
All right. Your cash component here, we're talking money market funds, certificate of deposit. You're not going to get big returns here. It's your safest investment, though. You're going to want to think of that as your safe harbor. That you know, if everything else bursts into flames, that's the one element of your portfolio that's going to kind of shelter you from the storm. Keep that in mind as well. And you're going to balance these things differently as you go forward. So let me ask you, Chris, do you like doing puzzles?
I do like doing puzzles.
Me too. Absolutely. I like crossword puzzles. I like jigsaw puzzles. I love seeing how things fit together. That's exactly what we're talking about here. And when it comes to asset allocation, it's fun. I mean, it might seem daunting. It's fun because you're going to determine how the various pieces work based on the various contextual issues, you know, your time frame, your risk, your job, your family. And I always look at that sort of thing as a puzzle where I get to adjust it as we go along. And if you look at it like that, it actually becomes, you know, an entertaining and instructive thing to do. Now, once you get into advanced class here, then you go even deeper, because then you're going to start breaking apart some of the various assets and diversifying them as well. So, for instance, in your stock component, yeah, you might have an S&P 500 index fund. Then you might add an international fund to give you some more cosmopolitan flair there. You might add a tech fund. You see where I'm going with that?
Yes, sir.
And then with bonds, you might have government bonds, you might have corporate bonds. So there's ways that you're going to parse those as well. You could even split apart your cash. And then once you become a total Bill Gates or Warren Buffett about this whole thing, then you might start factoring in things like commodities, precious metals, you know, some of that stuff. Real estate, for example. Now, that I don't go there first. That's not for the faint of heart, but that's another way that you can diversify your portfolio. And, you know, take your time, go smoothly, go steadily, and get a real handle on your finances, and you're going to probably sleep a whole lot better at night. Work for you?
Yes, for sure.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for the call. That's all the time we've got for right now. I'm going to move the mailbag down back onto the floor. Always good to hear from you guys. To submit a question of your own, all you got to do is go to marketplace.org.
Helping you become a better money manager is something we live for here at the show. But there are times when even the savviest advice isn't enough. For some people, clear limits and boundaries are required to get control over bad financial behavior. That was the case for Ryan Jaffe. He's a recovering alcoholic and co-founder of the Next Step Prepaid MasterCard. It's designed for former substance abusers and marketed as a way to curb excessive spending during the recovery process. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What are some of the issues that you're trying to deal with here? What is it that a recovering addict or recovering alcoholic is up against financially?
What it really comes down to, and this is from my own personal experience, is whether it be drugs or gambling or alcohol, that was a way to cope with life. And then you remove that from the equation and someone's getting sober and now you have a scenario where they're trying to fill their void with other things. And a lot of times it comes in the form of spending.
But you're talking about it as if you're dealing again with that sense of I'm going to fill the void somehow. What about people who are having a hard time staying on the wagon? Is this card going to put up enough barriers to going out and indulging yourself, to going out and getting a bottle of Jack Daniels, to going out and getting some crack?
That's a great question. And I want to make clear, this card is not by no means a foolproof plan or a relapse prevention tool. If someone wants to go out and drink or they want to go out and use, they will find a way to. And we're not sitting here promoting that this is a way to completely stop someone from engaging in that behavior. But in the same hand, because our card, one of the features of our card is we remove cash from the equation. They can't get cash back at ATMs or point of sale. They can't go to bars, liquor stores, nightclubs, gambling establishments. So if someone is serious about their recovery and they're having a bad day and they don't have that $20 bill in their pocket, that's one less option for them to engage in negative behavior. And again, this is based off my personal experience and experience of friends of mine. But this isn't a long-term solution. This isn't something where I see a kid using this card for a year or 2 years. This is to help them in the transition from treatment back into society and help them get to the point where they're self-supporting, but they're doing so in a responsible manner.
I want to turn now to John Olsheimer, who's president of consumer education at smartcredit.com. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right. So we've been talking about this card that is intended to address the situation of someone in recovery. It's intended to address the frustrations of family members or friends or supporters. One thing we didn't talk about was the $14.95 monthly maintenance fee. We did not talk about the $9.95 activation fee. Is this a smart deal?
So I am addressing this from a purely financial angle, and I want to make that clear. And I've been tracking prepaid debit cards for many years, and they've become the hot product over the past 12 to 18 months, primarily because of the influence on some celebrities who have decided to essentially attach their name to these types of products.
Yes, Kim Kardashian, we're talking about you.
Kardashian, Susie Orman, Russell Simmons, Alex Rodriguez, Lil Wayne, George Lopez, Magic Johnson, and now most recently Justin Bieber. But from a purely comparative perspective when it comes to prepaid debit card fees, $14.95 as a flat monthly fee is on the top of the market. But having said that, you also can't use the card at an ATM machine, which is where most prepaid card issuers are really racking up the fee-based revenue.
All right. I see that. I guess when you see a product like this, you can see the merit in it. Ryan talked about how this addresses things that aren't necessarily out there in the marketplace, but can a piece of plastic not just affect a person's behavior, especially behavior that in the case of someone in recovery can be very egregious, but also the person, the family member who is trying to put some controls on that?
I think it acts as a very low barrier. It is not a long-term solution. It does not help you build credit. It's simply a piece of plastic with stored value on it. Now, look, I don't mind annual fees. Don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-fee. If you give me $25,000 of available credit of your money, I'm okay paying a $50 annual fee for that. But when you start nailing me with $14.95 a month for access to my own money, that's when I start to think that we're not really teaching people the right way of using money.
I want to turn back to Ryan Jaffe very quickly. I'm a character from Breaking Bad. I'm listening to the radio right now. Tell me why I want this card.
This will allow them to spend their money in a healthy manner. And maybe they'll look back. And we actually did have a scenario where a girl, she had actually called us up directly to ask us why her card wasn't working at a tattoo shop because she wanted to get a tattoo in her first couple weeks. And we explained to her that that's one of the areas that's restricted. And after having a conversation with her, she actually pointed out to us that, you know, she hated the card at first, but because of the transaction cap specifically, she started by making bulk purchases, and she was able to look back and she realized that she saves a lot of money that way. And hopefully that carries into the future when she's supporting herself and she takes those behaviors and she applies them to her own life.
A card that stops my kid from getting a tattoo. That got my attention right there. Ryan Jaffe's one of the co-founders of the Next Step Prepaid MasterCard. John Olsheimer is president of the consumer education at smartcredit.com. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Ever seen how much paperwork is involved in buying a home? And if you find yourself unable to make mortgage payments, things can become even more complicated and confusing. There's no easy task getting clear answers from your mortgage lender. Wouldn't you like some straight talk from a banker? Us too. So we asked Jess Tirado of Wells Fargo Home Mortgage to stop by for a little chat. He's a senior vice president and regional servicing director who lives in the Inland Empire, east of L.A. Right, Jess, I'm guessing you get a lot of hard luck stories coming over the transom. What is it that makes an application for a refi or a loan mod stand out in the eyes of the bank?
Well, what we look for is obviously we want to make sure that the customer is qualified for the mortgage, that we're going to be able to give them a loan that they're going to be able to afford and make the payment on. So, you know, in any loan situation, what we're looking at is that you have credit, that you have collateral, and that you have capacity, meaning that you have the income to sustain the loan. We want to make sure that anybody who gets a loan today can service that loan for the time that they have it.
But the problem is when I come knocking at your door, I'm probably distressed. Mm-hmm. Chances are I've lost my job. I'm going through a rough patch. I need a little bit of help. Everything you've just described is something that I can't give you.
Right. What I was describing was more of a normal purchase transaction or refinance transaction. We know that there are people out there that are still struggling with their mortgage payment. We ask all customers, as soon as you run into any difficulty, in fact, don't even wait. If you know that there's going to be a change in your financial situation, let us know ahead of time. You don't have to wait until your mortgage is delinquent. And it could be a lot of people immediately think they need a modification. It might be a repayment plan. You know, you had a hardship. You're back on your feet now. You just can't get caught up on your payments that you missed. We can work with that. And so there's different solutions to each financial situation.
But if I contact you as soon as I say lose my job, but I've still got some money in the bank, have I improved my chances of getting some assistance, or have I just waved a red flag that I may be having difficulties within a few months?
Yeah, no, not at all. In fact, we encourage that. Like I said, we want to know that ahead of time. We had a teacher in the Inland Empire, which is where I live. As you know, schools have been hard hit with what's going on in our economy. And so she was notified in advance that her contract was not going to be renewed for the next year. So she was employed today. She knew she was going to be employed next month, but she knew next year she would not have a job. So she thought she had to wait until she became delinquent. And that's when it was brought to my attention. I said, no, absolutely not. That is a situation where you know your financial situation is going to change as soon as the next school year starts. So we got her in contact with our home preservation specialist, the folks that deal with this. They asked her for some information. They wanted to see a copy of the letter that she got telling her that her contract was not going to be renewed, looked at her credit, looked at her financial situation. And in that case, we knew they were going to go from a two-income household to a single-income household. We were able to do a modification for her just using her spouse's income. And so we got a modification ready for her ahead of time so that when she didn't have the job, we could lower her payments and help her out.
But you're making that sound very kumbaya, and yet I hear constantly from people who feel like they're either getting the runaround from the bank or they can't get anybody to return their calls, or on the one hand, they're working on a loan mod, and on the other hand, they're working on a foreclosure at the same time.
Right. Right. You know, years ago when we started in this crisis, you know, there was some confusion. There were some things that, you know, we had to work out. I mean, as you know, this economic crisis has been unprecedented in our time. So none of us had the, you know, the luxury of having experience in this. I think what you'll find now is that a lot of that has changed. We at Wells Fargo, we've adopted the single point of contact model before it was required because we knew that would be the best way to help a customer. Now you're dealing with one person. We've added just a lot of team members to deal with those issues. I think we've learned a lot, and it just works a lot better for customers now.
Not to be rude, but Wells Fargo was just among a number of major banks that ponied up $8.5 billion to settle federal charges related to the so-called robo-signing mess from a few years ago when mortgage and refi and loan mod applications were being processed without even a second glance. Is all that now in our rearview mirror?
In terms of the settlement, you know, what I want to say about that is, you know, the process was, you know, very complex. But we did learn a lot, not just Wells Fargo, but I'm sure all the other banks that were involved in the process. I think we it helped us clean up a lot of the, you know, the issues that led up to that. I think the settlement accomplishes what the government wanted to do, which is namely, again, you know, help give some money to the folks that may have been harmed during 2009, 2010 in the foreclosure process.
All right. So for anybody listening who is contemplating either a refi, a loan mod, or just a conversation with the bank, what would you advise to improve their chances of getting a favorable outcome?
Just tell us your story. What is your situation? What is happening in your life? What has changed? Contact your bank early, and they can help you work through the options that might be available for you.
Jess Tirado is Senior Vice President of Wells Fargo and a Regional Servicing Director. Mr. Tirado, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you can also tell us your story. We want to hear about your experience as an underwater homeowner. Have you contacted the bank? What was your lender's response to your request for assistance? Visit us at marketplace.org to share your story. Hungry? In a moment, we'll delve into the big business of Super Bowl munchies. But first, it's lunchtime. It's a necessary part of any workday, but have you noticed that sometimes, maybe even frequently, you return to work feeling all sluggish? Well, now there's a new way to beat post-lunch laziness. Instead of taking your break at the drive-thru, hit the dance floor. Boogie fever. Caitlin Carroll reports from Berlin.
It's about 12 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon, and the Franz Club in Berlin is full. Not with the typical 20-something hipsters, but with middle-aged workers on their lunch breaks. Some wear suits, some wear sneakers. All of them strut their stuff on the dance floor. Martin Burkle manages a team of electrical engineers, and he's brought them to the club. Is it embarrassing to dance with your coworkers?
The first four guys are already on the dance floor, so they still look a little bit shy, but I think they'll get there somehow.
Virgil and his colleagues have come here as a kind of team-building exercise. But others, like job consultant Petra Leitmeier, came to make new connections.
I never have been dancing in the middle of the day, except in my own living room. But people may use these kind of parties as a networking opportunity.
This lunchtime disco, or lunch beat as it's known, is new to Berlin, but it's already established in many other cities around the world. The idea started in Sweden in 2010 as a way for health-conscious office workers to break up the monotony of work and get a little exercise. Since then, clubs and even corporations like Microsoft have begun hosting these one-hour afternoon dance sessions. Ola de Schweda is the DJ at Lunch Beat Berlin. He says the idea is simple.
It's a party at an unusual time, and it's unusually short, but it's a party. You go dancing. Basta. But we don't serve any alcohol, yeah, and the food involved is what is called brain food.
If you want beer or cocktails, you're out of luck. But healthy stuff like energy bars, fruit, or fresh juices are always on hand. Ola de Schweda says this kind of activity can help make workers more productive after lunch. But Lunch Beat is not all about business.
It's great for flirting and for for coming in contact.
Vanessa Del Rey is a sex coach. She comes to Lunch Beat for the physical effects.
I'm feeling great. I'm energized and I'm happy. I'm laughing and I'm sweating. It's a good feeling for the rest of the day.
As the Lunch Beat wraps up, engineer Martin Burkle takes a break from dancing with his coworkers. He says they've loosened up a lot since they first got here. Some are sweating and smiling.
I think it's especially in a conservative environment like we're working or in conservative company. I think it's a lot of fun to see them actually dancing and having fun and going out and wild. If they're also going to be more productive, I don't know. But at least they've seen themselves and the rest of the team in a different environment, and I think that will help.
Whether or not it helps to dance with your boss is debatable, but people at Lunch Beat Berlin do seem to have a lot more swing to their step than when they walked in. In Berlin, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Super Bowl Sunday is about the big game, of course, but it's also about the grub. Chips, dip, hot wings, and of course, pizza. Domino's Pizza alone expects to sell more than 11 million slices on game day and says its delivery guys will cover the equivalent of 300 round trips between San Francisco and Baltimore. To see how a company gears up for the Super Bowl of pizza eating, I dropped by a Domino's outlet in Culver City, California, where I met franchise owner Dan Hosseini.
Welcome to Domino's.
Thank you. I'm David. Is the owner around?
Hi, I'm Dan Hosseini.
You run this place?
Yes, I do.
How many pizzas do you guys make in a day?
Usually in a normal day, but about, say, 100 to 200. But as we go throughout the week, towards the end of the week, on Friday, Saturdays, we tend to sell more. And range anywhere, our stores range anywhere from say, 400 to about 500, 600 pizzas per day.
So like on a Saturday, you're moving maybe 600 pizzas?
Usually. That's a pretty heavy day for us.
All right, what about Super Bowl Sunday?
Oh, boy. Super Bowl is also Super Bowl for us. We tend to get much busier than average. Usually we do maybe anywhere from twice to three times the normal volume on Super Bowl Sunday.
All right, wait a minute. Now you're talking about as many as almost 2,000 pizzas?
Well, I think our stores range anywhere from, say, 400 to about 1,200 orders.
That's a whole lot of pepperoni.
That's a whole lot of pizza.
Do you have to bring on more people for this?
Oh, absolutely. As I was mentioning to you, it's Super Bowl for us, too. So all hands on deck. We've got the entire staff working, prepping from early in the morning, getting ready for the business. So all the folks that are working inside the store, the entire management team, the entire driving staff are scheduled to work. And then we're really working literally from 8 o'clock in the morning prepping all the way to midnight, 1 o'clock, just to manage the business.
Now, you clearly give a lot of thought to this stuff. Do you go to bed at night thinking about all this?
I dream pepperonis all the time.
Yeah, who doesn't? Do you have one of your drivers around?
Absolutely. Mike?
Hey, yes, sir.
Hey.
How you doing? You drive, right?
Yes, sir.
Did you work Super Bowl Sunday last year?
Yes, I did.
All right, so how long did it take you on average to get a pizza to somebody who's ordered one for the game?
Well, I would say we still pretty much, you know, hit the target. I mean, within, you know, 30 minutes. But, of course, on Super Bowl Sunday, there's a lot more business. So you have to take in account, you know, sometimes, you know, the ideal time that I'd like to get a pizza to the customer is it's a little longer just because we have so much business on that day.
What do you tip on a pizza?
What would I tip?
No, what would I tip?
What would you tip?
Yeah.
Well, it depends how generous you're feeling.
Well, let's say I'm digging my pizza. Let's say you hit that 30-minute mark, which I'm really impressed by on Super Bowl Sunday. 20%?
That would be really nice. Yeah. Of course, depending on the size of the order, but I think that would be a very generous tip.
So you're expecting to clean up this Sunday?
Yeah, I definitely think so.
And is there any other holiday, Dan, that comes close to Super Bowl Sunday?
Well, I think quite a few. Halloween is just incredible. Halloween is really, really, really busy. Obviously, one of the other occasions is New Year's Eve. So, you know, from ranking, I would say Super Bowl is probably the busiest. New Year's Eve, second, and then Halloween is quite busy.
And I'm guessing that if the game is close throughout, you're selling more pizzas. If it's a blowout, you kind of taper off.
True. Usually during halftime, we get ready to get rocked. I mean, we get all lines coming in, and now with our online apparatus, the floodgates are open. So we get down 40, 50, 60, 70 pizzas in a matter of a minute or two. So we have to really catch up. So during halftime, we do really well. But if the game is close, like this one will be, 28-24, 49ers, that's my prediction, I think we're going to do really well.
But you've got a problem, and that is Beyonce is singing at halftime. So at just the moment when people should be ordering their pizzas, the men of America glued to their television.
Yes.
What are you going to do? How does even Domino's go up against Beyonce?
Well, I couldn't imagine that. I would have one hand on speed dial and then my eyes on Beyonce. That's probably what's going to happen to me.
Dan, Michael, this has been illuminating. Thank you very much for taking me through Pizza 101.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, go Niners.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
My thanks to Dan Hosseini and delivery guy Michael Walker. What are you hottest for this Super Bowl Sunday? The game, the gambling, the guacamole? Marketplace's Jason Slotkin and Paresh Dave asked football fans in D.C. and L.A. to weigh in.
Hanging out with friends, having some good pizza, watching hopefully a good game. Hopefully the Ravens win. And maybe a little offside action with some buddies of mine to help offset the cost of the pizza.
Yeah, I'm interested in seeing the two brothers, the Harbaugh brothers, play each other.
But I think that's pretty cool that two brothers are actually playing for a Super Bowl. You wonder who the mom and dad are going to root for. Is it going to be the mom root for one, the dad roots for the other? I just love watching the game. Sitting and watching at home, living room, 42-inch flat screen, right in front. Got the best ticket in the house.
What I'm looking forward to this Super Bowl are the ads. They tend to get a bit more creative with them, and they're funny, and then you get to see, they take more time to think and actually sell products rather than just marketing sex and stuff like that.
Every year I'm interested in the ads, more importantly than anything else in the Super Bowl, because the commercials, they pay so much money for 15 seconds or 10 seconds of a recognition, and I really enjoy those commercials because they go all out.
My friends do a snack stadium, so it's a little mini food stadium thing. There's sandwiches and popcorn and chips and dip, and it's one of those things where you just have like wings and you sit around drinking beer with your friends and everyone is into it. Regardless of whether it's your team or not, everyone, all of my friends get together and sit down and watch the Super Bowl.
So I like football, but I like to, kind of do something else in the meantime, whether it's hanging out with friends and drinking beer and having some snacks, or switching between that and Animal Planet's Puppy Bowl or their kitten halftime show. So I keep it interesting. I've been watching football for a couple of months, but the Puppy Bowl only comes once a year.
Pizza time for us, so that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplace.org, or you can get in touch on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, how credit card debt inspired creativity for one young artist.
Another monthly round of these machine-generated credit card statements. It was just kind of these statements of doom, essentially. And I felt absolutely powerless.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Lindsay Foster Thomas, John Ketchum, and Daryl Perinata. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Have yourself a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the Subscribe to Podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.